He walked over and told his son he should probably start getting loose. John's arm was shot from that morning's game, and he doubted he could get the ball over the plate with any snap, but he dutifully started preparing. Dale Otta, the most organized and conscientious of the boys, became particularly agitated. This was the state finals. Where was their coach? Behind the bench, the parents fretted. It was decided that Bob Schartzer would take over as coach if necessary. Finally, with only 5 minutes to spare, Sweet pulled up outside the field in the school van. Next to him, Steve Schartzer jumped out of the passenger seat carrying a crumpled-up ball of athletic tape, the remnants of the trainer's work. With a quick hop, Schartzer made for the mound. Around him, the Macon fans rose by the hundreds in the heat and began cheering. Their hero had arrived. From the press seating, Joe Cook watched and wondered if he'd been wrong. What if this kid could do it? By this point, Schartzer had pitched 4 consecutive shutouts in tournament play. Granted, he'd thrown 7 innings only a day earlier, and his left hand appeared to be bothering him. But Cook had learned not to underestimate the boy. Then again, Waukegan had an ace of its own on the mound. Tall and with dark Hollywood looks, Paul Wade Zunis had pitched a 5-hitter in the tournament opener and was 7-0 on the season. Though not overpowering, the junior reminded teammates of Orioles ace Jim Palmer, a pitcher who could move the ball around and hit his spots. He had a good fastball, a curve, a slider, and a changeup. As Cook began to jot down the lineup, he got word that one of the Waukegan players, a boy named Frank Gaziano, wasn't playing due to heat stroke. It was going to be a rough one. When Cook finished, the lineups for the 32nd Illinois High School State Baseball Championship looked like this. Waukegan. Jim Davila, left field. Joe Reitzevich, first base. Mike Aremovich, catcher. Hal Holstein, third base. Bert Berechke, shortstop. Jack White, right field. Jim Dietmeyer, second base. Joe Moretti, center field. Paul Wade Zunis, pitcher. Macon. Mark Miller, second base. Dale Otta, shortstop. Steve Schartzer, pitcher. Stu Arnold, center field. Dean Otta, catcher. David Wells, left field. Jeff Glenn, first base. Brian Snitker, right field. John Henneberry, third base. The game began, and Schartzer felt it from the first pitch. Something was off. He walked the leadoff hitter, who then stole second base. The next batter, Reitzevich, singled and stole second as well. The Iron Men weren't accustomed to this. Usually they were the ones stealing bases. Behind the plate, Dean Otta smacked his glove in anger. On the mound, Schartzer, usually so proud of his pickoff move, stewed. Then Aremovich drove in a run with a ground ball. 1-0, Waukegan. Up stepped third baseman Harold Holstein. A dead pull hitter, Holstein was a big lumbering boy, slow as the devil on the base paths, according to teammate Joe Moretti, who could hit it a mile. Even so, he proceeded to do the most unexpected thing. He squared to bunt. Henneberry and Glenn were playing a mile back at the corners, and Schartzer was caught off guard. Who puts on the suicide squeeze with their cleanup hitter? What Schartzer didn't know was that, unlike so many teams that had taken Macon for granted, Waukegan had scouted the Ironmen. After the semifinal that morning, Waukegan assistants Rick Moen and an old coaching friend of Mallory's, Tommy Carell, returned with 2 pieces of advice. You can run on them, and you can bunt on them. This wasn't a big surprise. At the time, bunting was a common tactic in Illinois high school ball, and often an effective one. Given uneven diamonds, pitchers who were unsure fielders, and third basemen unaccustomed to making throws on the run, just getting the ball down often led to an error or a base hit. Whereas this was indeed a good strategy against Hanaberry, who had limited fielding range and who had pitched the semi that Waukegan had scouted. Schartzer was another matter. Not only did his fastball tend to rise, making it difficult to get down a good bunt, but his defensive range was such that when he played third, as Mount Zion coach Ed Neighbor says, it was like the kid was also playing short. Put Schartzer on the mound, and he could cover the whole middle of the infield. So when Holstein sent a bunt trickling down the third base line, it normally wouldn't have been effective. But now not only did the big Waukegan kid own the element of surprise, but Schartzer was hobbled by a bad glove hand. Charging the ball, Steve knew his only play was at first, and another run scored. Now it was 2-0 Waukegan. An inning later, it got worse. Uncharacteristically, Schartzer lost control of a fastball and plunked a batter. A stolen base and a passed ball later, Waukegan had another run. Macon was in a 3-0 hole. Meanwhile, just as in the early innings of the Lane Tech game, the Ironmen were listless at the plate. Unlike against Lane, however, there was no mid-game rally. One Ironman batter after another hit weak grounders, due in part to the sinking motion on Wade Zunis' pitches. Making matters worse, Macon received no help from the Waukegan defense. Without many walks or errors, the Ironmen couldn't get on base, and without base runners, they couldn't create havoc. When they did have one opportunity to run, Removich had unholstered that howitzer and gunned down the would-be thief with ease. It wasn't until the fourth inning that Mark Miller singled for the Ironmen's first base hit, but his teammates couldn't bring him home. Then, in the top of the sixth, Waukegan struck again. Removich singled to right for his sixth hit in 10 tournament at-bats, a two-day hot streak he later called the best hitting days of my life. A wild pitch sent Removich to second, and then Schartzer, to his amazement, was called for a balk. No one called balks in the Meridian Conference. With Removich on third, all it took was a lazy sacrifice fly to bring him home. The scoreboard now read, Waukegan 4, Macon nothing. In the stands, the Macon fans sat looking glum. They'd used up so much energy earlier in the day, and it was so hot, that the slightest exertion was draining. Even Cliff Brown, with the giant flag, was listless. Only one inning remained in Macon's fairy tale season, and this was how it would end. And then, in the bottom of the seventh, a glimmer of hope. Schartzer crushed a pitch to deep left that barely curled foul, and then, unfazed, he stepped back up and stroked a single. An error, a wild pitch, and a ground out later, Schartzer tore home to score Macon's first run. Moments later, Wells singled to drive in another, prompting Mallory to yank Wade Zunis in favor of Rick Hoppinen. Wells greeted him by stealing second. Now the Ironmen were down only 4-2 with one out. Better yet, Jeff Glenn, who was leading the Ironmen in batting average during the tournament, walked to the plate. In the bleachers, the Macon fans rose. The purple flag whipped through the heat. As it did, it was joined by an unusual but familiar sound. Bang, bang, bang. Shirt unbuttoned to his navel, shades on, mutton chops thick with sweat, the Lane Tech drummer was now on the Macon side of the bleachers. He'd been so impressed with the Ironmen in the morning that he'd decided to stick around. Maybe they'd need his help. So now he slammed on the drum, as around him, parents and students and little kids roared with him. All afternoon, this is what they'd waited for. One more shot. In center field, senior Joe Moretti readied himself. He knew Glenn didn't have a ton of power, so he played in a bit. During long summers of American Legion ball, Moretti had played on plenty of impressive fields, but Minon was the finest he'd ever set foot on. The grass was perfectly groomed, like a warm green carpet. He crept in even farther, knowing the ball wouldn't take any strange bounces. Then, on the third pitch to Glenn, he heard a crack. Standing off second base, Wells heard the same noise and saw enough to know Glenn had muscled an inside fastball and that it was headed toward left center. Head down, Wells took off for third. Tall and lanky, he was one of the fastest players on the team. As he approached third, he looked up, unaware of where the ball was. All he saw was Sweet waving him home. Down the first base line, Glenn rounded the bag in time to look up and see two things happen at once. Wells tear around third, and the center fielder field the ball cleanly. It would take a good throw, Glenn thought, but he could get him. Seeing the ball soaring toward him, Moretti had charged it hard. After scooping it up, he did what he'd been taught to do for so many years. Don't think, just react. So he came up firing, aiming to throw the ball right through the chest of the cutoff man, as Mallory taught all his outfielders. Behind the plate, Mike Aremovich watched it all play out. The soft liner, the big kid taking off from second, Moretti scooping it up. When he saw the Macon kid round third, Aremovich gauged the distance to Moretti and began yelling at his shortstop. "Don't cut it! Don't cut it!" This one needed to come all the way home. In center, Moretti heaved the ball and watched it soar. Back in Waukegan, the school's field sloped downward from home plate toward the outfield, so he was accustomed to throwing slightly uphill. At Minon, however, because of the way the field's drainage was planned, it was the opposite. Now he was throwing down toward the plate. Moretti knew it would give him a touch more power on his throw. Only once he'd released the ball, all he could do was watch. From the stands, Jack Hanaberry followed the arc of the ball, his breath wedged in his throat. Outfield throws at the high school level were a risky proposition, especially without a cutoff man. Often enough, they ended up offline or skidded to the backstop. Surely, Hanaberry thought, the kid must be feeling the pressure. Decades later, when the local paper ran a story about the greatest moments in Waukegan High sports history, number two on the list would be Moretti's great throw. Those on hand say they've seen few better. The ball came in straight and true, bouncing once between the rubber and home. Later, Sweet would say, it had to be on the money. If the kid had to do it 10 times, we're going to score 7 or 8 times. As it was, Aremovich caught the ball a few feet up the third base line. Seeing Wells coming in standing up, he did what he'd been taught. He hid the ball behind his glove, reached up with both arms, and leveled his opponent in mid-stride. Wells went down, and the ball stayed with Aremovich. The umpire looked, paused, and then yanked back his fist. "He's out!" And just like that, the Macon magic evaporated. Had Wells scored, it would have been 4-3, with one out and a runner in scoring position. Instead, it was 4-2, with two outs. The Macon fans settled back into the bleachers in disbelief. It seemed a formality when the next batter, Brian Snitker, sent a chopper down the third base line for the final out. The Iron Men didn't have much time to grieve. No sooner had they finished shaking hands with the Waukegan players than the boys began receiving congratulations. Moments later, they were summoned to the infield. There, the IHSA Executive Secretary, Harry Fitzhugh, held aloft the second-place trophy. It wasn't as large as Waukegan's and was silver rather than gold. A shiny miniature batter crouched on top, frozen in mid-swing. "And now," Fitzhugh said into a corded PA system, "I give the second-place trophy to Coach Smith and the Iron Men." If Fitzhugh noticed that Coach Smith was trying to stifle laughter as he accepted the trophy, he didn't let on. Immediately, Sweet passed the trophy to the players, who gathered around him in dirty uniforms, sweat streaked down their faces. One by one, they raised the trophy over their heads, to the cheers of the Macon faithful. The crowd was still going when, a few minutes later, Waukegan was honored. Mallory complimented the Iron Men players, and then said, "I would like to commend those fans seated right over there." Then he pointed toward the Macon horde, hundreds of whom had stayed and continued to cheer. Off to the side, a wide, powerful man stood, taking it all in. Itchy Jones, the SIU coach, hadn't come to see Steve Schartzer, but he sure as hell was glad he had. To Jones, Schartzer looked like a kid who could play at the big-time Division I level. Schartzer wasn't the only one being scouted. Lakeland College coach Gene Creek was also on hand, attending his sixth straight state tournament. Creek was different from many of the old-school coaches of the day. He was younger and sported his own set of bushy sideburns. After the game, he sidled up to Joe Cook. "Does Sweet have a master's degree?" Creek asked. Cook said he didn't know. Creek nodded. "If Sweet can inspire the kids to play that well, I should hire him as an assistant. I'm serious." A few minutes later, when Cook mentioned this to Sweet, the coach smiled. "Nice of the man to say," Sweet said. But he couldn't talk right now. A night like no other awaited him. 20. June, 1971. Had you walked past Route 51 on the evening of June 4th, 1971, you would have been forgiven for thinking Macon had won the state title. The caravan began in Peoria, 15 or 20 cars long. After dinner, the Iron Men stopped at Millikan University in Decatur, honoring a pregame promise Sweet made to a local radio station, and the parking lot turned into an impromptu pep rally. The asphalt was clogged with friends and family, as well as kids from local high schools and small-town people who, as Trussner says, just wanted to be part of something. The players streamed out of the bus, accepting the hugs and high fives. All except one, that is. During the ride from Peoria, as his teammates peered out the windows of the bus, soaking in the sight of the caravan of cars, Schartzer had hunched in the back, lost in himself. The guy who'd pitched two games with one good hand, who'd vowed to pick up that damn flag, who'd spent all season galvanizing his teammates, blamed himself. "How can we have this celebration when we just lost?" he wondered. When the bus reached Millikan, Schartzer remained on it, wedged into his seat. Finally, Bob Schartzer climbed the bus stairs and walked to the back. He didn't say anything at first, just sat there for a moment. All those games of checkers that Bob wouldn't let Steve win, all those lessons taught on the living room rug, all those years of repeating his mantra of "concentrate, goddammit," now he needed to impart a different lesson. "Son, did you do your best?" Steve looked up. "Yeah, I did." He paused. "Well, no, I didn't. I made some mistakes, and it hurts." The father looked at his son. He put a hand on Steve's shoulder. "Whether you're happy with it or not, you've got to learn to live with the good and the bad," Bob said. "Now it's time to come on out. There's a whole damn town out here that thinks you're a hero." Slowly, Steve Schartzer rose and walked down the stairs, out into the madness that awaited. Millikan was only a warm-up, as it turned out. By the time the team hit Elwin, 5 miles north of Macon, fire engines joined the caravan. Soon enough, a police escort arrived to lead the bus and what the paper later estimated was 3 miles of cars. Horns honked, townspeople ran out of their houses to wave. Kids who'd been allowed to stay up late whistled and screamed. The bus rolled into town, past the Arrowhead Tavern and the grain elevator, rumbling by churches and homes, then finally came to a stop in front of Macon High. Since it was close to 11 p.m., many of the players expected to go to bed. Instead, they were directed to the school auditorium, on the double. There, waiting in the thick summer heat, were the rest of their classmates. Senior graduation had been set for 8 p.m., perhaps the most formal event in Macon. It included a processional, an invocation, a clarinet solo, and a presentation of awards. Pre- and post-graduation parties were planned at the houses of parents around the town. When word came that the team would be arriving late,